morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sensei.
Every now and then it happens that life doesn't conform to our schedule. So this has been a very crazy week. One of the ingredients, which I'll mention right now, I've recently gotten into rock climbing. And in rock climbing, I strained my knees. Also, did everybody see the email that Bill sent out regarding the student-teacher relationship? I was hoping to actually have a prepared talk about it today, but also this week, my wife actually coughing after choking on a walnut injured a disc in her back. And so it's been in intense pain, so much of my day has been spent helping her out. I wanted to talk a little bit more about student-teacher relationship as a follow-up to the email, and I didn't get to do that. So I'll sort of do it off the top of my head as best I can. But most of you who are involved in Zen, if you've read the books and stuff, know that a lot of the famous teachings that come from Zen history have to do with encounters between teachers and their students. So there's something very rich and very productive about having a relationship with a teacher. Now, I had a relationship with a teacher for almost 10 years, and it wasn't until near the end of the relationship that I realized that, I'm his student. I mean, in any formal way. This is Roshi Kennedy. I had started out a long time ago in New York City at the Asian Studies Society with Edo Shimano Roshi, and then spent about 5 years with Bernie Glassman. But nothing formal ever happened. I would just go and I would sit. And then Ray Cicchetti, who you all know, started sitting with Bob, and we're friends. And so he said, well, you're going to sit with Bob. So I started sitting with Bob. And I would get up in the morning twice a week before work at 4:30, go into Jersey City and sit and go to see him and Daisan. And this went on for 10 years. But nothing was ever said about whether I was his student or not. You know, after sitting for a while and having a couple of experiences, I remember asking him, I said, Roshi, am I ready to do koan study? He said, sure, start now. And he tells me which book to go to, and so, you know, but he never directed me. But I've since learned that that's unusual, that in most Zen communities, there's a sort of a formal way of, if you're interested in having that kind of relationship with a teacher, usually there's something in writing and there's a directive to how to go about doing that. It's not required. It has to do with the student's temperament, a person's temperament, if they would want to have that kind of more personal relationship. You know, it's sort of a mentor, guide, friendship kind of thing. So now that I have more time on my hands in retirement, I'm trying to devote myself more to being a Zen teacher and more to looking at more efficient ways to how can I best serve the Sangha as a teacher, you know. So being a teacher has sort of been a gift that you get, you know, sometimes when you do this practice. So I want to share that as best I can. So that's where the backdrop to where that email came from. So that email sort of outlines how you would explore the possibility of a student-teacher relationship. And the way that I see it, my understanding, nobody taught me this, this is just the way that I see it, is that no two students are the same. So it's not like the student-teacher relationship here would not be every student does the same thing. There are some places where you go and you sit for a certain period of time, and after you've sat for a certain period of time, then the teacher assigns you koans, and that's like that. Or like if it's San Francisco Zen Center, you do Shiken Taza. Partly in our lineage, the teachers are more creative. I mean, you mix and match. And so as a teacher, I would think the best way to serve a student would be, well, first of all, a student would have to start out and have some time just being on the cushion, learning how to do the actual physical sitting well, posture, work with breath, spending more time, devoting more time to it, fitting it into your life more, and then going from there. So that would sort of be the same, you know, depending upon who comes in to ask for this kind of relationship and how long they've been sitting and what their practice is. But after that, it could be very differently. I mean, a student's temperament could be very well suited, based on how I understand them and see them and collaboration with them, for just sitting. That's not an easy practice to just sit. But sometimes there are students who can just sit, and then that's what they want to do. So that would be sort of the basis of the relationship. Other times, students will have learned from sitting that a lot of emotional stuff has come up. Frequently, it's anger. So there are ways to work with meditation on how to sit with anger. Noticing, you know, anger is an emotion. Well, almost always, I would venture to say always, an emotion is preceded by thought. So if you're sitting and anger comes up, you know, you can work with that anger by watching your mind, becoming familiar with your mind. What thoughts are coming up, or what memories are coming up that are bringing up this anger? And then bearing witness to the anger, welcoming the anger. You know, most of us want to push these powerful emotions away. But if we welcome the emotion and you have somebody there to go through the process with you, many times it can teach a lot about ourselves. And it can also teach us how, by not tending to it, we've lived a life of separation, compartmentalized. And this practice is about getting rid of all those compartments, you know, letting them, not getting rid of them in the negative sense, like fighting against them, but letting them drop away, softening our grip on those compartments and all our ideas about who we think we are, and welcoming in who we really are. So that would be another way to do it. Sometimes students will come to practice because of stress. They're looking for relief from the stress of life. And, you know, they've read in all the magazines that, well, meditation is a good way to work with stress. So that might be another way of working with a student around using the practice of sitting to work with stress, and maybe ultimately even going beyond that, just exploring the question of, well, who is it that's stressed? Who are you when you're stressed? So that's sort of generally it. I'm just giving a few examples, but it depends on who the student is, because in that email I talked about tailoring the practice to the student. That's what I mean by that. It's sort of like I'm also a therapist, so when somebody comes into therapy, so, you know, the question is, so where do you start? Well, you always start where the person is at. Even if you can see that maybe they ultimately will be better served being over there, you can't take them over there if they're not ready. You have to start here. This is where the person is at. They want to talk about their awful husband or their horrible wife and not realize that there's a whole bunch of other people in the room when they're talking about their horrible wife or their horrible husband. So the same thing with the spiritual practice. You start where the person is, and we work from there together. But it's a collaboration. It's a friendship, a spiritual connection that we make and share. And I can hopefully, as a teacher, offer all of the years of study that I've spent and you know, all the times that I've fallen on my face and struggled, etc., to help guide whoever this person is that's the student, discover who they are. This is a good opportunity to give an example of how working with a teacher is not necessarily conventional. My bell is outside, but sometimes a question is not answered in the conventional way. A student might ask a question like that, ask the teacher to discuss something like that. And I might... and say thank you. Now, that's not meant to be trivial or to slight the person, but it's a different example of how to respond. And over time, there may be times when the answer is direct. It depends. But, you know, that would be done, again, more one-on-one, more personally. I'll give you a simple example. Sometimes somebody will come in and they've already had 3 cups of coffee and they're upset about something that happened during the week and they want to come in and they want to talk about all that happened. They're talking a mile a minute. Well, sometimes the best way to serve somebody is to just bring them back here right now. So by ringing a bell, you bring the energy out of the head back into the body, and the person, you're basically asking the person to just simply be present. Just sit here with me. So that sometimes is a response. So the Zen relationship is not a typical relationship because sometimes it can be unconventional. Other times, it's totally conventional. It depends. It depends on the student, on the moment, and whatever else is in the room at that time. many students that come to a spiritual practice come because they're suffering. And many times that suffering involves the psychological realm. And they're looking for the spiritual realm as a solution. The spiritual realm is not always a total solution. All you have to do is look around in the lineage of all the of Zen and find out how many teachers have had mental health issues, either alcoholism or sexual addiction or all these other kind of things that have gone wrong in these communities. So even enlightenment is not an eraser to our psychological stuff. So for me as a teacher, a relatively new teacher, there's a gray area. How far does a teacher move from the realm of the practice into the realm of the psychological? I'm still exploring that for myself. But for example, somebody will come in and they'll say, you know, I'm stuck with my practice. I'm so frustrated. I can't just... And so I'll simply say, well, do you feel that right now? You feel stuck? Yeah, I feel stuck. I can't, you know, they'll tell me the story about it. And I'll say, well, I'm going to ask you a question. Just tell me the first number that comes to mind. I say, how old does this make you feel? And, you know, invariably they'll say, I don't know, 6. And I'll say, okay, right now you're taking up this struggle from a place of being 6 years old. Some whatever there is about this has activated in something in you that's very young. Now, I might choose to ask them to sit with that, see what they discover, see if they, well, you know, what was going on in your life when you were 6 years old, right? And so when you're sitting, take that up as a question, like as if it were a koan, a traditional koan. And then depending upon where that goes and the stability of the student, I would go from there. A lot of times it's necessary to, there's a whole concept that's written about in the Zen world about spiritual bypassing, where people want to use spirituality as a place to hide out from their psychological issues, you know, get blissed out and not really face the underlying distress. So again, it depends. I don't have a cookie cutter answer, but the two sort of overlap. Sometimes it's necessary because of the timing of it and the availability of it. An adjunct to practice is psychotherapy. You're working both sides of the fence. What does practice do? Well, certainly if you learn to sit, it stabilizes you. You know, if you think about your work with the mind, you know, and so you're sitting with the breath, and all of a sudden you get pulled away from, by, you know, the mind pulls you off in a particular direction. And the practice is, all right, just notice it. Notice the thought, and then you just come back and you start going with the breath again. Pretty soon you go in another direction. Taught to come back again. If you start doing that thousands of times, you're teaching yourself in a very subtle way to be stable. So just sitting allows the student to be stable, not only physically stable, but emotionally more stable, so you can take up this other kind of work. The other thing that happens is, a lot of students find, and this comes up in practice, when you start to get quieter, you start to notice stuff that you never noticed about yourself before. This kind of emotional stuff from the past starts to come up, so it starts to become present. Now, there was something else. For example, sometimes this emotional stuff becomes a barrier to practice. And I've used this in talks before, but I was raised in a household where my father was abusive. I had been abandoned as an infant. I wasn't told that. I was raised by a stepmother who I was told was my real mother, but she dealt with me very differently than my brother. Okay. And my way of adapting to that, sort of saving myself as a kid, was to go behind a wall, to just shut down and say, I didn't literally say this in my head, but as an adult, I could tell you what I did was, I made a commitment I was never going to be vulnerable in this situation. It wasn't safe, especially with somebody who was abusive. So fast forward to now I'm a dedicated Zen student at a retreat. And all of a sudden, as part of the process, part of the spiritual process is to become vulnerable, to become open. You know, as you let down all these constructs about who you think you are, that's a vulnerability. That's an intimacy. And when that started to happen to me, it terrified me. So I was a therapist by that point. I realized, I didn't talk to the teacher about it, I realized that I needed to do work with this, you know, because I was never going to be able to go further in Zen practice unless I took care of this, because I had to be vulnerable to go farther into this practice. So I started doing both things on my own. But if that were to happen with a student, I would suggest to the student, I would share, like if you were asking me this, I would say, well, this has been my experience. If you're feeling vulnerable and overwhelmed by the vulnerability or the intimacy of practice, again, I might say, how old do you feel? Well, I feel 3. Okay, so this is something young. So you're going to have to, we can't work with this. This is much too rich to work with 5 minutes at a time. You need to find a place to work with this. And we would work both sides of the fence. But because I'm a therapist, and if they were sharing what was going on, I could be able to sort of tailor the speed and what they were practicing spiritually. I'm smiling because after all these years, I I feel an affection toward my father now, who was vulnerable, and I feel badly in a way sometimes using him as an example, like this, you know. So I see much more clearly now as an adult, and having healed myself of the stuff that having a relationship with him caused, I see his own woundedness and how he got. And why he was the way that he was. So my father is dead, but make some kind of cosmic apology, or maybe not an apology, but to thank him for the opportunity to use that as an example to help somebody else. So, thank you.